Hello, this is The Leg Show. We're going to get started in just a couple minutes here. In the meantime, if you have IRC access, be sure to join us at irc.thelinuxshow.com and channel Pound Linux Show. So hang in there. We'll get started right after these messages.
You're listening to The Linux Show. Or maybe you're thinking about it. I don't know. This is probably a commercial. Want to find out about Linux and open source? Check us out, www.linuxshow.com, for the best in Linux community news. Check us out.
This is The Linux Show for Tuesday night, September the 10th, 2002. And it's September. Not only September, it's September 10th. What a spooky day. Man, but here we are, live once again, having taken our last week of summer vacation off last week for the Labor Day holiday, and we're back, and bringing you another edition of the Tuesday Night Linux Show, once again live, and we're going to chat about the latest and greatest within the Linux community. We're going to have a special guest on tonight, a little later on tonight. Sometime during the next 20 minutes, got to give him a quick email to make sure he doesn't forget. But Eric Raymond will be joining us during the second segment of the show to discuss a couple of topics with us. But the rest of the crew is here. Starting out in California, we do have Arnie. Arnie, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Beautiful day today here in California. Of course, it's always beautiful, but things are going pretty well.
Yes, today was, something happens about the middle of September here in Illinois, and what that is that all of a sudden the jet stream kicks over, and it just happens from one day to the next. And so today the jet stream kicked over. Yesterday it was 90 degrees, today it was like 60.
Beautiful weather. You can send some of that this way if you can.
Yeah, it's at least 90 here in Santa Barbara, which is a rare thing right now.
Yeah, it's like 90 some here too.
But it's gonna be real bizarre here in Illinois for the next like 3 weeks while the city makes up its mind whether it wants to continue with summer, go ahead and go into fall. We will have this daily cyclical changes between 90 and 60 that is just really bizarre. And it's actually September that got Chicago its reputation of, if you don't like the weather, wait 15 minutes because it'll change. And it is really, really true here in September. The weather changes on an hourly basis, it seems. But, Doc, I heard you chime in. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Aside from the fact that I'm in a room full of computers that's even hotter than the 90 degrees outside, everything's fine.
Are you at home?
Yeah, I'm at home.
No air conditioning?
We don't have air conditioning here. We don't do air conditioning. We have that. It's called climate. But it doesn't always work. That's the problem with it. Sometimes the climate fails, you know, and there's nowhere to go.
You don't have a control on that, eh, Doc?
No. You got one on yours, Arnie?
I just crank it up and it gets hotter.
You've been in the fire zone, haven't you? I mean, have you been breathing smoke?
We're right. The big fire in the mountains is just around the corner here, and we were right in the shadow of Mount San Antonio here, and the Mount San Antonio is a great sunset the last week because of the smoke.
Do you want to tell the listeners what started the fire?
What was it? I can't remember.
Some people were doing animal sacrifice.
That's it, animal sacrifice.
Animal sacrifice.
You know what?
Welcome to the wrong part of California.
One gets the feeling that the animal sacrifices somehow didn't work.
Right. They sacrificed something else.
Yeah, well, why don't you try something else?
There's a Darwin report in here of some sort.
You mean the Darwin Awards? Yeah.
Sitting out the gene pool, for sure.
If they died. We don't know if that happened or not, but I think they have to die to qualify.
Your fires in California, something else happened in between the last show and tonight, and unfortunately I ended up getting sick when I was out in Vegas because I had every intention while I was out there of renting a car and going to the Burning Man Festival.
That's a long drive.
And it's a long drive, but so what? I mean, how many
It's a beautiful drive.
I mean, how many times do you get to go to the Burning Man?
Absolutely.
So missed that. Maybe next year. That was my goal, was to go this year, but ended up getting sick and missing out on it. But on the opposite end of the country, you got Russ Pavlicek. How are you doing tonight, Russ?
Oh, I'm live and in color, I'll tell you. It's been inside the 90s out here as well, that relief that's in the Chicagoland area is supposed to hit us tomorrow, and
it's about time,
believe me.
Yeah, it's definitely going to hit you guys because it's blowing down the lake real fast. I was standing outside in my lawn just about 10 minutes ago looking up at the clouds, and the clouds are rocketing by at like 50, 60 miles an hour. It's just amazing.
Wow.
So it ought to be hitting you pretty soon.
Should be fun landing at O'Hare right now.
Yeah, sure. But Russ, it's got to be a little strange there tonight, being that it's September 10th, 9/11 Eve.
Yeah.
Is there a real down attitude towards everybody where you're at?
I don't think down is the issue. Pensive is more like it. There's sort of a thoughtfulness that's running deep, and the TV stations around here seem to be running endless documentaries and commentaries regarding 9/11.
And speculations on how much they have to protect the Washington D.C. and New York City areas.
Yeah, although frankly, I've seen less of that. I mean, I've certainly heard the news reports on that, but they seem to be dwelling far less on that than on this contemplative reflection of what's gone down inside the last year and so forth. But it's interesting. And today, of course, we had our primary elections and whatnot within the state. So, you know, there's just a lot of different thinking out there right now, and as people are taking part in the voting process and so forth, I think a lot of people are thinking more and more about the attack.
You got to bring up the volume a little bit, Russ.
Sorry about that. I think I'm at full bore now. How's that?
Okay. Well, the moment ago when you were talking straight into the phone sounded a lot better. So just keep that volume up.
Okay.
Well, yeah, that's perfect. That's perfect. That's a good level. It's really really interesting around here. I'm really sort of tempted in a lot of ways to just turn the TV off tomorrow and ignore it all in terms of the coverage of the mainstream media. Because I don't know. It just at least what they're doing with the local media here seems a little bit ghoulish to me. So I don't know if it's.
I've had enough of it.
Well, I'll tell you, for folks inside the Washington area, you're going to have an issue tomorrow because at the moment when the Pentagon was struck, the metro system is supposed to, from what I understand, more or less pause for 1 minute.
Sure.
And
I hope they let everybody
know. I hope they get it started again. Turn off the lights in the metro also, and we'll find out how exciting things can be.
Yeah. No, they're doing some sort of announcement and other things, but, you know, there's this, everything's highly mindful of what's going on.
Well, I had a friend that offered me to do a consulting gig. That would have meant I would have had to get into an airplane tomorrow. And I turned to her and I go, are you fucking out of your mind? Do you really think I'm going to get on an airplane on September the 11th? It's crazy.
I would have no trouble doing that. I think it's probably one of the safer days to fly, actually.
Yeah, well, okay.
But that's me.
Okay.
I think what's going to happen is it's not going to happen anywhere they expect it if it happens and when it happens.
Well, of course not, Ernie, because that's why they call them terrorists.
Yeah.
If it happens where you expect, then you're not terrorized.
Yeah, well.
So. Yeah, well, and of course, Kevin and I are here in the studios in Aurora, Illinois. Sorry to say this is one of the last times we will be saying officially Aurora, Illinois, although a lot of the equipment is still going to stay camped out at Kevin's house because the servers are getting moved out of the old Farnsworth building in Aurora probably this weekend, and the majority of our servers are going to be coming out of of Chicago over the course of the next 2 weeks. So, I mean, we might still be using the Aurora handle for a couple more weeks yet, but we'll see. Let's go ahead and jump right into the first segment. And, well, let's see. Russ, it's been a few weeks since you've been up first up, so why don't you get us started tonight? What's your hot story of the week?
Well, I'm sure other people are going to talk about Bruce Perrin, so I'll just jump in on that when inevitably someone brings it up. But the one that for me is kind of the sleeper, but I think very important, over on Linux Today, and I think Linux Weekly News had a copy of it too, there was an announcement that SGI broke a world performance record with a Linux-based Itanium 2 cluster. And the interesting thing about it, as far as I'm concerned, is not the PR part of it, but the part that they mentioned, that's the 64-processor cluster, and that they achieved linear scalability.
Excellent.
Now, that, for me, you know, and I've seen some comments from some people saying, well, you know, I don't know if we can rely on that for all applications. Well, that's not the issue, as far as I'm concerned. The fact that someone like SGI can scale the thing up linearly to 64 CPUs means that a lot of the FUD that goes around about limitations in the scaling of Linux is going to take a knife in the back from this. If you can get 64 processors scaling linearly on just about anything, then you're doing pretty good.
Well, yeah, as of yet, I have not heard anyone, including Microsoft internally, make the claim that they've actually gotten the Windows 2000 data center server to actually scale up to the 64 CPUs they claim it's capable of doing.
So, the fact that we have a press release from someone who isn't the vendor just sort of mentioning, as by the way, it did scale linearly, that's great news.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's absolutely great news.
That comes, well, that's as close as you can get to theoretic limit, you know, linear scaling.
Yeah. I mean, that's absolutely spectacular as far as...
Yeah, you know, at that point, though, why don't you just go out and buy IBM mainframe?
Well, but the thing here, you know, I'm thinking of it more from a... from the positioning standpoint, whether or not it makes sense to buy a 64 processor machine, you know, I'll leave up there. But as long as Linux couldn't play in that arena, then Microsoft and some others would use that as a card against Linux solutions. Oh, it doesn't scale beyond a certain amount.
Well, fun anyway.
Excuse me?
Well, fun anyway. I don't think
NT
runs on anything like that.
But the fact that's no longer a playing card, or it's not going to be much of a playing card for people trying to knock open source is tremendous, as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, I'm not overly concerned if certain workloads don't scale particularly, you know, to that level. The fact is it obviously can be done, and as long as you can say it can be done, then it's worthy of a press release. God knows in this industry all you need is one proof point, and someone will put out a press release about it. So the fact that we can point to it and say, hey, you know, don't worry about scalability. Linux is there. And that goes from the Zorus, and Arnie before the show was talking about his Zorus. You know, you can have anything from the Linux on the handheld up to a 64 processor, up to an IBM mainframe, and it's like, you know, This is reality, folks.
Same thing everywhere, too. That's the best thing. My Zorus really is impressive. I am awesome, awed by it. It just does the job.
And likewise here, I picked up a Zorus at Linux World. And
isn't it phenomenal?
It does not leave my side for very long.
No, I've got myself a little leather pack I bought at the Computer Expo this week, and now it's not leaving my side at all. It's strapped to my belt all the time.
Well, the fact that now I have my wireless card for it, which I use at home here, so even when I'm cruising around the house, I can be checking my email and stuff like this if I'm cooking or something like this, and I have the little modem plug-in for when I'm on the road. It's tremendous. It really is. And, you know, that's one hell of a story, and I think it's one of the stories that we need to be telling in the marketplace that from these marvelous multifunction little handheld units all the way up to the great biggest of the big iron, Linux is there. And that's a great, great corporate story.
Okay, got any more for us this week?
The other thing I found interesting over at Slashdot, there was a mention that apparently Europe actually has more Internet users than U.S. and Canada combined. Europe has 186 million, U.S. and Canada has 182 million. And I just found that interesting, quite frankly.
Okay.
Of course, that study was done by a company in Ireland.
Yeah, well, hey, you know, it's not like you don't get any unbiased studies on this side of the Atlantic either.
Okay, and we'll just wait a few more years and count them up in India and China.
Exactly. And the thing is, though, I think especially, you know, those of us over here in the U.S., we get kind of blindsided that the market is this stuff that we see around us. And that's only a piece of the market. There's a huge, huge market out there. That's once you start crossing oceans, that needs to be addressed, and you cannot put on blinders and say if it's this way in the U.S., it's this way across the world. No way. And I think this is one of those stark reminders. And like you said too, that we haven't even begun to see India and China. During Linux World, when the Chinese delegation was there and they were talking about some of the things they want to do, this is serious stuff going on, serious stuff, and Linux is in a great position to capitalize on it all.
And you think about China, because China is such a big market. I mean, biggest in the world. If China, I mean not the government, but China the country, starts adopting Linux in a big way, I mean, we're talking, you know, talk about world domination, folks. The brain trust that they can devote to helping develop the open technologies is amazing. And you know, go for it. And Microsoft is very worried about China. They're spending lots of money in PR and lots of money in marketing to recapture the high ground on the operating system, you know, debate there with result, you know, again, in China, and it's yeah, I've been following that the last few weeks, and it's a pretty interesting debate, and of course Microsoft calls it operating system choice, when of course the only choice they want people to have is Microsoft.
Yeah.
Okay, well, seeing as you're talking anyways, Arnie, do you have a story of the week for us?
Yes, there is an absolute superb article in the New York Times, and Russ already mentioned it. It's the title is Balancing Linux and Microsoft. I sent a link a couple times into the chat room, and I'll send it again here. And this is an article about Bruce Perens and his leaving Hewlett Packard a few days ago. And I was really sad when I heard about this, because Bruce is one of those persons that is just, you know, has oodles of credibility in the Linux world, and has some practicality to him. And here he's working in Hewlett Packard, and a word on the street is that his leaving was because he, you know, basically he's a fierce advocate for open source.
Well,
and one of the things that they didn't like at Hewlett Packard was his advocating open source and open technologies in government, which of course is against the Microsoft.
He opened an alternative site to Microsoft's new derivative site.
Yes,
that was the big thing.
Let me give you a few more points as to why Bruce left.
This article, before you do that, this article is a great article and really, really has a huge dose of clue. The writer of the article is really, really clued into this, and Bruce was able to communicate with him very effectively. I highly recommend a good read.
Yeah, well, that may be, but first of all, you always have to take, I've learned this, I've been taught now, that you always have to do any communication or any interaction with Bruce that you have has to be taken with a grain of salt, because he has a tendency of poisoning his own wells because of his caustic personality. So that invariably was part of his problem over at Hewlett-Packard, because that has historically been a personality part problem. With
and this is the point at which I carefully say nothing.
Hi, Eric.
I was wondering when your silence would come in.
Hi, Eric.
Eric. And besides that, in defense of Bruce, okay, it was inevitable. It was obvious that he was going to leave Hewlett-Packard. I sent Doc an email on this issue about two and a half weeks ago, saying that, going to happen any moment now. And the reason why I said it was going to happen any moment now was because the, I forget her exact title. We'll just give her the title of Worldwide Linux Grand Poobah. Her name is Judy Chavez at the new Hewlett-Packard. She came over from the Compaq side, and I met her at Caldera's Geo Forum. She was one of the keynote speakers at the event.
Oh, my.
And this woman, and Russ, you're going to get a kick out of this.
Oh, I'm sure.
This woman went on to continue the fine tradition of total and 100% management incompetence about Linux. This woman stood before a room full of people who had been selling computers for the last 15 years of their life and said, basically, Linux on the desktop was irrelevant and that the new Hewlett-Packard had no interest in it. And she got laughed at. People in the audience could not believe that she was making the statements about Linux that she was making on behalf of the new Hewlett-Packard. Well, the new Hewlett-Packard is the same Hewlett-Packard, and it's the same Compaq, too. They don't know what they're doing when it comes to dealing with Linux as a product. They have no clue whatsoever. They're lost.
They don't have any idea what they can use it for.
Well, I tell you, she got up in front of this crowd and said, oh, what our plan is, and it was as if they had taken a bunch of IBM press releases from the IBM website and inserted the new Hewlett-Packard. And I want you to remember that phrase, the new Hewlett-Packard. You hear that phrase, the new Hewlett-Packard, on everything they do now. They're trying to convince us that they're better now, that this merger is somehow magically. You take two companies that totally suck and mix them together and somehow it fixes them.
That's a great.
There goes that sponsorship right there.
There you go, Jeff, mincing words again.
Well, I'm sorry, but I would have loved to have Compaq or Hewlett-Packard as a sponsor. Compaq used to be a sponsor a couple years ago, but the fact of the matter is they're clueless. They keep on firing the most talented people within their company when it comes to interacting with Linux development that's going on.
Are you including Bruce in that description?
Pardon?
Are you including Bruce in that
description? I don't know if I would include Bruce in that description. But, I mean, come on. Let's talk about fundamental idiocy. This company let Mad Dog walk out the door. That's all you have to say is that. And that shows just how totally clueless those people really are. To lose that kind of a valuable asset, that level of a valuable asset, to just let it walk out the door. That's the epitome of ridiculousness. Well, I'm sorry, Arnie, I stepped all over your story. But
that's
I just had to.
It's a good read. I highly recommend it. It's helped someone snagged it and put it up on the Linux Show site because this is good press for us. And that's what this is all about.
Okay.
The other story I found is one I snagged off of Slashdot, and it hit Monday on the International Herald Tribune, and I will get that link up on the chat room now. And what this is about, this is a study that claims, that claims that Linux has now snagged the desktop
championship from Macintosh. Now, that's not a whole lot, but according to International Data Corporation, Linux has a 3.9 share of desktops worldwide, outpacing Macintosh's 3.1%, which is interesting. This is the first time we're hearing this.
I sort of robbed my story there. That's all right. I've tried to get the source of that is Dan Kuznetsky at IDC, and I tried to get him to qualify that a little bit more. In fact, I tried to get him to explain to me why IDC's latest numbers are based on sales rather than volume, which is what they've been in the past. In other words, I think this is on Slashdot too. It may have been on one of the other.
Yeah, they've changed the metrics in the last.
They left out a metric, and I asked. What I did is I literally sent Dan, who's generally very forthcoming and helpful, emails that I've been getting saying, hey, what happened to these guys? Who's paying them? That kind of thing. And what's up? And I haven't heard back. And when I did ask him about this particular issue, he said that even though Apple sales are going through the roof compared to where they were before, again, it was less than a one-story building, but nonetheless, they have been going up dramatically. He was standing by his existing numbers, calling for more Linux desktops. Now, I'm not sure where he gets that or what that means or anything. I'm inclined, since I didn't get a good answer on that last question, to take his numbers a little more salt than I used to. I think also we have to factor in China. China is selling. If you could go into the Fry's Electronics and the Circuit Cities and Best Buys of China, and you often don't find Windows laptops at all and Windows desktops. You find Linux desktops.
And Macs.
Yeah, but the thing is that in some places, and Dan Gilmore of the Mercury News has reported this, that you see Linux desktops, you know, in stores, something you don't find in the U.S. for the most part. I mean, we know that Walmart sells them online, but you're not going to find one going into a Walmart store.
I beg to differ.
Really?
That was what I was about to step in on.
Oh, this is your news.
Walmart has started selling, and this is a scoop, folks.
Wow.
Walmart has started selling Linux boxes out of their stores.
Wow.
Cool.
Wow. Just like China. Now, where?
I have not gotten, I've been begging Walmart to give me numbers of what they're generating off their website.
Yes.
And they won't give me numbers at all.
We will refrain from cheap shot analogies between different vast totalitarian empires.
Yeah, but the remarkable thing is when the store managers got aware of the fact that these Linux computers were selling in relatively good volume off of the website, the store managers themselves started calling Walmart and saying, hey, we've got no CompUSA in our market. Let's start putting these computers and printers into our stereo department, along with the digital cameras and the game machines.
Wow, gotta love that.
And so it was driven by the store managers themselves. At least this is what I'm being told by the people at Walmart who have leaked me this information. And the couple of stores where they've actually started to deploy them, and they won't even give me the names of the locations yet, but they said they can't keep them in the stores.
Okay, so we have to put something up about that. I mean, I'm interested, anybody on the IRC channel seen their local, been to their local Walmart right lately? That'd be an interesting question.
Yep, but it will be, I'm sure this is not going to last as an experiment too much longer. They're not going to be able to keep it quiet too much longer.
Oh, well, no, we'll see to that. We'll fix that problem.
Yeah, we'll fix it quick.
That can be fixed.
Being able to get sales figures would truly rock.
Yeah, that'll be very hard. They don't do that.
Yeah, they're very, very tenuous about any numbers at all.
In fact, an interesting thing about Walmart is they generally don't even do PR.
Yep.
It's just not something they do.
We're Walmart. We don't need to.
Yeah. Everyday low prices, that covers it. As far as they're concerned, their slogan covers a lot of ground.
That's right. And everyday low prices is exactly what that Mitel box with Mandrake is doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
now, what about the Lindo's box?
I should say, by the way, that I'm actually not anti-Walmart. When what you are is a huge retail chain with a supply chain more complicated than the logistics of the Normandy invasion, being a totalitarian empire is very functional.
I have to say, not long after Klutrin came out, one of the first people we heard from talked about how clueful Walmart was, and I've met Lee Scott, who runs Walmart, and he's one of the most down-to-earth, okay guys I've ever met. Good guy.
And their employees are happy for the most part.
Yeah, and they love getting $8.95 an hour. It beats flipping burgers where they could get the same amount.
Yeah. Well, that's because they have built Walmarts where in places where that is high wages.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, that's true. And apparently maybe the employees can live in the back room, too. I don't really know.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, it was only like maybe 2 years ago that I actually found my first Walmart. I mean, here's a $190 billion worldwide company, and I'm such an urban animal, I never even saw one.
That's because they don't exist in Blue Country.
No, they don't.
You
well, you know
the demographics
thing is,
I'm talking about?
I looked up, there are like four of them on the peninsula, but but where are they? I didn't see them.
Do you know the demographics I'm talking about?
Oh, I know exactly. Yeah.
Walmart goes to the places like where my house is, Holman is in Michigan, Big Rapids, which is a small town, and they went into town, and every single hardware store on Main Street closed within a year.
Yep. Yeah. That'll
too bad. Now you can't get some things in that town.
Well, the interesting thing is we had that happen here. Walmart came in.
Russ, we can't hear you.
Okay. How about that?
Yeah.
There you go.
Keepers. Okay. It's the dang headset is sliding on me. Sorry about that. We had the Walmart come in about a year and a half ago now in my little town where I am. And I was waiting, based on the predictions, for the rest of the town to fold up and go away. The strange thing is we haven't seen that here. I mean, we got stores coming out the wazoo, including hardware stores and everything else, and I've yet to see anything that's rolled up and died that wouldn't have done so under its own mismanagement to begin with.
Huh.
Yeah, I have no doubt that that does happen, but I also have no doubt that a lot of that is urban legend.
Yeah,
you know, it's much easier to blame a business failure on a big out of state corporation than it is to accept that either you screwed up or your market's drying up.
Yeah.
In this case, that was clearly not the case.
In most business scenarios, competition actually generates more business than less business.
That's what Starbucks claims. That wherever they go, they tend to go where there are already coffee shops. And if the other coffee shop has good coffee and a strong clientele, they often do better.
Yep.
That too may be an urban legend, but who knows?
No, Starbucks got data to support it. They say it's not a zero-sum game. They're not taking a customer away from the whatever the other chain is. They said they're bringing two stores together are bringing in three customers rather than trying to fight over one. And that's what's happening.
It's remarkable how many human beings are willing to part with $3 for a cup of coffee.
Yeah, isn't it?
And it's incredible, including me.
I don't drink the stuff myself.
Yeah.
And
you're a richer man for it, too.
Or $16 for a gallon of water, too.
Right.
So, okay, well, Doc, do you have a hot story of the week for us?
This may just be a transition thing, but I spent a bunch of today thinking and writing about 9/11, and I wrote a piece that's going to show up tomorrow in Linux Journal, probably at about 5 in the morning. There's a little bit of a forecast of it on my weblog, which you can just find by looking up Doc on Google, like right after the Department of Commerce. But it's kind of weird, but anyway, there it is.
The second biggest doc in the world.
Yeah, exactly. Bigger than the gunslinger, bigger than the dwarf even. You know? Anyway, bigger than the dead dictator, all those guys. Anyway, I was looking at the Wall Street Journal this morning, which had their online version had a review of the six designs for the that have been submitted to the to the whatever group it is that's looking at new architectural designs for the replacement for the World Trade Center, which I never bothered. I mean, I saw some drawings about them before, but I never paid close attention to them. But they actually had like a, you know, some kind of real video three-dimensional or four-dimensional runaround thing, and ugly as that stuff can be, for God's sakes, I did look at it. And they weren't all that bad when you got to look at them that way, but I realized every single one of them had a, they were all smaller than the Twin Towers. They all had buildings that were smaller than the Twin Towers, but they still, in a very phallic way, stuck that TV transmitting tower up into the stratosphere, so it still peaked out at 1,500 feet. So in other words, the overall profile, as they put it, and included a 1,500-foot element in the middle of it. And the idea, of course, is that they would be able to put the TV transmitters back up where they were. Well, it started me thinking, I said, why would they want to even bother doing that, given that the FCC has mandated digital television, HDTV, by 2006, and analog TV goes to hell after that anyway. I mean, I don't know if that's actually going to happen, but that's the mandate. And with digital television, they're already finding that, you know, it's a cellular approach is much better than having one big brute force transmitter sitting on top of the highest building. So I thought, well, what, after I spent some time sort of discrediting that whole idea, and I remember when I was in New York when they built the Twin Towers, that they moved the transmitters to the top of the North Tower of the World Trade Center, in part because the towers caused a great big shadow toward South Jersey from the Empire State Building. Well, that shadow's gone now, and the new buildings probably aren't going to cast the same kind of shadow, so why bother? So anyway, so I thought about what should the new World Trade Center celebrate? And I thought, well, why not celebrate the NAP? Why not celebrate the Worldwide Commons? Why not celebrate the worldwide bazaar that the World Trade Center is supposed to represent, rather than build a cathedral, to borrow a metaphor, yet another cathedral which, you know, wants to stick its phallus up into the sky, why not build something that supported or celebrated, you know, the wonderful economic environment that the NET has created. And by the way, at the same time, stick a thumb in the eye of Hollywood, which is busy trying to shut that down. Kind of a New York versus L.A. thing. So I just wrote up a piece about that. It'll be up tomorrow, and I invite people to give their thoughts on what they think the new World Trade Center ought to
You know, be. Doc, on the other hand, I think maybe I see some value in symbolically saying, you know, you hit us with your airplanes, but we're back bigger and badder and more phallic than ever.
On that level, I don't have a problem.
especially if it's a phallic...
Speaking as a guy, and a guy who's chased down big towers and loves those things, you know, before I die, I want to take an elevator ride to the top of one of those 2,000-foot TV towers. I've always wanted to do that. And I never have, so that's another one of my goals. But anyway, it's just a thought, you know, positive thing on the anniversary and all that. And
okay.
It's a Linux angle too, because I think I think it'd be a really cool thing to install free infrastructure in the new World Trade Center of all kinds, web infrastructure, net infrastructure, and share it with people. So there.
Okay, Kevin, do you have any product releases from the last 2 weeks for us?
Well, the most exciting news for people looking for stuff to hack Linux onto is the company that originally made the broadband adapter for Dreamcast has offered to make another 1,000 if they can get enough pre-orders to pay for it. So if you can find an import company to order it for you, you can get it for $50 instead of the $175 they've been going for on eBay.
Really? Yeah, but the question then becomes is that $50 that you're going to spend that you're ever going to see the product? Because
never know.
You remember when Sony announced the Linux conversion kits for the PS2?
Yep.
I ordered one the day they announced it, and I still haven't gotten it.
It's cheapers.
Okay, and that was, what, February? And they were saying 5-week delivery?
You never know.
Any other products?
That's about it for this week.
I'm writing spam fighting software.
Pardon?
I'm writing spam fighting software.
Cool.
This is kind of interesting. Paul Graham, who is one of the most brilliant computer scientists alive,
amazingly lucid thinker, amazingly good writer, put out a paper a couple of weeks back called A Plan for Spam, in which he discussed a novel and radically different way of filtering spam. He said, forget pattern matching, it doesn't work. The spammers always game around it. Which is true, they do. He said, instead, just consider your incoming mail to be, each message to be a big bag of words, or rather word frequencies, and do some probabilistic analysis to figure out how similar it is to spam you've already seen. So you train your filter by telling it, this is spam, this is not spam, this is spam, this is spam, this is not spam. And as it builds, as you feed it messages, it builds its knowledge about what statistically spam looks like and non-spam looks like. And eventually it gets really, really good at telling the difference. And this is without maintaining elaborate patterns or trying to anticipate the latest wrinkle in MIME encoding or anything else.
Is this code based on genetic algorithms?
It's not a genetic algorithm, but it's kind of similar in spirit in some ways.
So it doesn't use a single word or a single string, but multiple.
It uses all the words in the message.
I bet you could do that with genetic algorithms too, though. That would be fairly simple.
You could. It's possible, but this is simple and it's fast and it seems to work really well. And in the thing that there were two things about his description that caught my attention. One is that it has a really, really low rate of false positives. That is, it almost never classifies anything as spam that is not spam, which is, of course, much worse than classifying something as non-spam that is spam, because you notice that. And the other characteristic he said was, well, it spits out probabilities. It says there's a 0.9 chance this is spam. And he said, the interesting thing is I very seldom get probabilities that are in the middle of the range. They're all tend to be either 0.2 or below or 0.9 and above. And that's what told me that this is actually a fairly robust method, that you don't get a continuous distribution of might be spam, might be. So I got really excited by this, and I went off and wrote a trial implementation in C. And lots of people are really excited about this now. I posted an 0.1 alpha version a little less than two weeks ago, and I got people piling all over it to help and to write mods and to speed it up and to make tuning suggestions. It's fairly interesting.
Cool.
I saw a couple of the implementations based on that floating around. On the question I had, has anybody come up with a reasonable method for it to get updated? Because I know a lot of users probably aren't going to want to take the time to always go through their mailboxes and feed it samples of spam and spam.
Here's what I do. I have two. I use Mutt, okay? And I set up macros in my Mutt.rc file. The BOGO filter distribution will tell you how to do this. It's on the man page. I set up two macros in my Mutt file, and as a result, it now has two delete keys, delete as spam and delete as non-spam.
Good idea.
So when I do D, it automatically appends the message I just deleted to the non-spam file, and when I do escape D, it automatically deletes it to the spam file. And every once in a while, I run a script that says, okay, take the current spam and non-spam files and grind them into a message database for BOGO filter. So without my having to do anything but decide which delete key to hit, my message base is pretty continuously updated. And since the method is statistical, I can get away with a certain small amount of categorization errors. That is, if every once in a while I classify something as spam that's not, or vice versa, that's not a problem unless I do it frequently.
So by doing this, you will eliminate that pornographic spam but continue to get your email about badminton.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Because what will happen is the word lists will carry the information that badminton frequently occurs in mails that are not spam and never occurs in mails
that
are spam.
Word that is the arbitrary one.
What?
It's the shuttlecock.
Yes.
Word.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Are we talking sack dirty again, Jeff?
Yes. So, as I said, over time it accumulates this information about characteristic word frequencies. And what it depends on is the linguistically interesting fact that spammers speak a different dialect of English than the rest of us.
Really?
Yes, it has a different vocabulary. They have all these loaded terms that they want to use all the time that don't show up in much normal email.
Really? What do you mean?
Well, when was the last time you got a non-spam email that had the phrase penis enlargement in it?
I have to use this as the point at which I would bring in. Look up on The Onion. The funniest thing The Onion ever did was a piece called Anti-Spam Legislation Challenged by Powerful Penis Enlargement Lobby. I love that. It's brilliant. It's so freaking brilliant.
So what happens is the it doesn't notice the phrase penis enlargement, but it notices penis and enlargement as word tokens that keep showing up in spam. And after a while, they boost the estimated spamicity of any message containing them so high that it just goes plonk.
Yeah, well, that's a fair bet. Yeah, very interesting.
Yes.
Very interesting. We are up to the middle part of the show, but I'm going to sneak in one more little thing before we take our little break. And that is an update on something that people in the IRC are always asking me about after the show, or people are always emailing me, reminding me that I made a promise about a month ago and still haven't made the announcement. About a month, month and a half ago, I was telling everybody, well, we've got this new sponsor that we're about to be signing up that has a really, really good DSL offer that is going to be coming down the pipe. And I kept on delaying the announcement. And part of the reason was is when I was talking to these people, I opened my mouth and proposed a what-if to them, and they sort of got excited. And so these two different vendors got together and started talking. And they have finally gotten their act together, and as of 5 o'clock, unfortunately it wasn't a couple hours earlier, or I'd actually have something up on the website for you. But as of 5 o'clock this evening, I got an email that they have finally got their act together. And so on next week's show, we will have the official announcement and point you towards a form on our website for the Geek Access DSL project. The Geek Access DSL project is going to have something special on it. It's not only going to have the ability of getting this low-cost business DSL that I was talking about a couple weeks ago, but they want to what I got them down together with was a couple of wireless vendors. And so the part of what the project is going to entitle is getting people motivated to build community hotspots in their neighborhood. And so there's going to be forms that we're going to have posted on the website so that if you get your if somebody is willing to do this, if they get themselves and at least five other of their neighbors together to sign up to commit to building a neighborhood hotspot to provide wireless high-speed wireless internet to their neighborhood, the DSL company is going to knock the price of the DSL down even lower for the first year of service to sort of cost subsidize the hardware for the wireless service. And so the DSL company and the wireless company, I guess, are going to be like splitting the cost between sort of like a rebate, that they're going to handle that between the two of them. People aren't going to have to mail in forms or you know, deal with coupons, receipts. It's all going to be done between the two vendors. And so it's really, really exciting. I just want to plant this seed in people's head. I was just glancing at the email and reading the numbers rough through. But just think of this in mind, that you're in a neighborhood, say that it's a block long, and you're sharing 1.5 megabit internet service with half a dozen to a dozen neighbors, and you're paying $20 to $25 a month for that service. That's all I'm going to tickle everybody with. Again, we'll have more information up on the website next week once I have a chance to really digest it and put it into a form for everybody. But we'll have that up on the site next week. But for now, let's go ahead and take a break. We'll be gone for about 3 or 4 minutes. Kevin put on a tune. We'll be back with segment number 2 of the Tuesday night edition of the Linux Show. Or what is this? September 10th, 2002. We'll be right back. Linux Show. We're in segment number two. For those of you in the IRC room, Will Wheaton will be here within a couple of weeks' time. We're still just tweaking the schedule with him. He's got a couple of projects that he's working on in terms of some independent film.
You know, he showed up in User Friendly today?
Really?
Yes.
I'll have to go check that out.
Yes.
But, no, he will be here as soon as we can get things jive together with his publicist, his people. So it's sort of funny. But anyways, we'll keep you updated with the Will Wheaton show. I think that'll be a lot of fun talking to him about his adventure at learning how to become a Linux geek. So, but we'll cross that when it comes to it. Okay, on to segment number two. A very controversial subject, I know this is going to be, because it had already turned into a controversial subject during the break in between the segments. And that is based upon a hypothesis that I am starting to formulate, starting to propose. And I didn't invent this hypothesis myself out of the blue. There have been a lot of people who have been questioning the impact of the GPL on the long-term development cycle for new products that the GPL is going to have with the product associated with the Linux kernel itself. And so I haven't invented this concept, this idea, but I really, in earnest, started focusing in on it a couple of weeks ago when I was at the GeoForum in Las Vegas. And let me give you guys a little bit of background as to why I'm saying this right now. And then I'll throw it out there, and everybody can tell me how wrong and how screwed up I really am on this notion. But anyway,
why don't we just cut to the chase and tell you you're wrong? No, never mind.
I went first dibs on it because I'm going to get run over by you guys after this.
There you go, mincing words, Eric.
Okay. Here's the deal. I mean, I'm at the GeoForum, and I'm in the middle of a room of perhaps, 350 to 500 successful business owners. Okay? It was a big, huge room packed with people who were presidents, CEOs, executive vice presidents, chief technology officers, whatever, of technology consultancy firms from around the world. Most of these companies could be defined as businesses servicing the SMB, the small business market, you know, and they were probably firms that had anywhere from, say, half a dozen to 20 employees, and probably had sales of somewhere around $500,000 up to around $40 million for their own firm. Mm-hmm. But bottom line, the people who were attending this event were not new business owners. Okay, this was a mature crowd. I actually felt young for a change at a computer conference, because most of the people there were either my age or older than me and had been business owners for 10 to 15 years. And so these guys, for the majority, these guys had been part of the hardcore AT&T / SCO / Novell / Caldera reseller channel. Okay, and had been part of that channel for 10 to 15 years and had ridden up and down the various economic trends with the SCO Unixware or whatever name it had 10 years ago and Novell products. And so these people were not, they're not ignorant, they're smart people, they run successful businesses, they create a lot of jobs, they sell a lot of products, they service a lot of customers, there was money flying all over the place. This is not a fly-by-night crowd. I mean, that's the impression I'm trying to get across to you guys. Plus the fact that the majority of those same people were in no way anti-Linux. They were very pro-Linux. Most of them have been Linux users for a number of years. Most of the people I sat down individually inside the back rooms of their consultancies, that was their predominant platform that they had been using internally.
And so what were they saying,
but the
Jeff?
Bottom line, push comes to shove. When it came towards putting product into the hands of customers, they had difficulty selling Linux. And it didn't matter whether you called it Caldera Linux or whether you called it Red Hat Linux, because the dirty little secret of the attendees of the SCO Caldera GeoForum was most of them sold SCO Unix, but they also sold Red Hat Linux. They didn't sell Caldera's Open Linux. And so it really didn't matter what kind of flavor of Linux you were talking about. They had difficulty getting it into the market. It wasn't easy.
Okay.
And so they, bottom line, they had trouble making money on it. They had great difficulty making money on it. And their client base had great resistance to buying Linux. Now, the irony is it was a piece of cake for them to buy Apache or some other function-specific product that just happened to be running on Linux, but they didn't even tell them it was running on Linux.
So I got a question for you. If you think the GPL is the problem with Linux, then why doesn't BSD rule the world? Why isn't BSD easier to sell to these people?
BSD doesn't have the applications.
Well, no, but the thing is, most of the software that can run over Linux can also run over BSD. There isn't that much difference in the APIs.
Yeah, but the port isn't very
the
automatic.
The critical mass of BSD isn't close to the Linux, Eric.
Mm-hmm.
But bottom line, Eric, my point is it really started making me think of what the future is for Linux. When I'm looking at what, to me, are people that we as a community should be looking at and listening to, because frankly, Eric, the history of Linux vendors has not been very good.
That's true.
Okay? We've screwed up.
Can I jump in here before we go to arguing about licenses and the rest of it? Here's just a quick observation. I mean, first of all, I think within the domain that you were hanging out in there, Jeff, your observations were legitimate. I mean, you're looking at one side of the market saying that I have trouble selling to this stuff to my people. But it's a huge world out there, just a huge one. So
No question.
Okay, that's A. B is, it's to me, the interesting thing about what happened at GeoForum was that now all of the formerly leading Unix vendors had a Linux offering. Okay, we have, so IBM, I mean, Linux has a seat at the table alongside AIX with IBM, HPUX with Hewlett-Packard, Solaris with Sun. Sun only made the announcement at Linux World in August. And now, alongside SCO. Now, SCO is a much smaller player than those other guys, but they're a pure software player. But nonetheless, let's take those four leading forms of Unix, and they've got a Linux sitting right next to them now. Okay, that's A. Now, there's an upside to that, which is, well, you know, Linux has, if it hasn't achieved world domination here, it's certainly at the table with these other guys, and that's progress. On the other hand, if you look at it in terms of retailing and in terms of shelf space, as it were, even if it's just psychic shelf space, I'm seeing a little bit, and it's not a clear thing, but it's a sense that I'm getting from some of these guys, that they're niching Linux, okay? It's like, okay, we have all of these solutions, that's the term they love to use, that we've sold you guys before, and now we can either put them on Linux or we can put it on this other stuff that we've sold you before. But, you know, Linux is, you know, you want our low-cost solution. You want our sort of, you know, the free server version of this. You know, there it is. But I think there's a little bit of a sense that as some of these companies, Linux is getting niched. It's like, you want our low-cost thing? Yeah. Okay. We'll give you Linux for your web server and your firewall and a few other and your mail server, but we're going to sell you this high price crap on some other platform because that's where it's always been anyway, and you feel more comfortable with it. And I think that's it's going to be a while before that sorts out. But I think it's there's a little bit of a shelf space mentality coming into that. So anyway, I just wanted to put that out there as just a kind of an observation right now.
Yeah, it seems like that particular expo that you went to, Jeff, would have had some bias.
Of course it would.
And even though they are Linux users and they like it, you know, the fact of the matter is their business has been structured, as you said, for the last 10 years, not selling Linux.
Of course it is.
You know, so
of course it is, honey. But we have to look at this very carefully about in terms of the reaction of why these guys all changed. They went from SCO to Caldera, and then back to SCO again. We need to observe with open eyes what they did.
It seems apparent that Caldera has moved them back to SCO because Caldera doesn't seem to get the Linux thing either. We really don't.
It's not that simple, Arnie.
No, it isn't that simple.
It's business.
Yeah.
They were making $60 million a year selling SCO products. They weren't making anything selling Open Linux. That's what it amounts to. That's really it.
Jeff is right about that. They had business reasons for going back to the SCO emphasis. And we should think about those business reasons really hard. I'm not prepared to state that I see a larger pattern there, though.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, fine. I'll buy that. There's no larger pattern there. We're looking at an isolated case, but for a significant percentage of that hardcore element within the Linux community to look at the situation over at Caldera and post comments onto Slashdot, such as, good riddance, they were a lousy Linux company anyways, we don't need them, and then turn their back on the solid reasons why they did what they did, and ignore the fact and pretend like that the Linux vendors have utterly failed at achieving good business models is a serious mistake for this community to make.
The fact of the matter is that Caldera has always had better Linux T-shirts than they've had Linux distributions.
Arnie, how many Linux distributions of Caldera have you actually launched?
I tried an earlier version of Open Linux.
Well,
and you know, I just didn't like it. It was just like it was.
Okay. But the blanket statement that you just made, Arnie, was typical of the reaction that Caldera has been getting. Believe me, I'm no apologist for Caldera.
Yeah, there's
I have been saying the same things you have been about Caldera. And the fact of the matter is, though, Arnie, if you take Caldera Open Linux and put it side by side and install it with, a like machine, it's going to install pretty much the same.
Yep.
Yeah, I blanked out there for a minute. It's going to install pretty much the same as most other Linux distributors.
Oh, the installation was pretty good.
Okay, and
it's like better than some.
Yeah, but so it's really unfair for you to make, judgmental statements like that. And see, that's the point I'm making, is that I think, in large way, a lot of what's gone on at Caldera historically has been because of my attitude towards ransom love and your attitude toward ransom love and everybody else's attitude towards ransom love. We threw out the baby with the bathwater.
I didn't.
There you go.
Eric? No, seriously. I was never part of the anti Caldera brigade.
You may not have.
In fact, the only serious interaction I had with him was at one point we sat down and had a conversation about getting some of the Documenter's Workbench source code released to open source, which he seemed to be quite in favor of. Of course, they didn't follow up, but he seemed to be quite in favor of it.
There's been quite a bit of software that they have done. Caldera has done, and some of it hasn't, but they've done some good, and their Open Linux has some was really aiming for a particular business niche. There could have been a market for that.
Let me suggest.
But it's not the same type of distribution that I would have wanted on my machines.
Yeah. Let me suggest an interpretation of Jeff's facts, which is that people will pay a substantial premium to have a product that they're comfortable with.
Exactly.
That they already have expectations about, and that they already have a track record with, and a history with, and that doesn't feel to them like stepping off into the unknown. And people are more likely to pay for that comfort level when they're established business owners who, well, are not exactly spring chickens anymore. So, I mean, I think that what Jeff saw was a real phenomenon, but I would be cautious about overinterpreting it. Now, as a separate issue, is the community prone to beat up a little too hard on outfits like Caldera? Well, maybe, but on the other hand, I'm not sure it's a real smooth idea to be taking Slashdot too seriously either in general.
Well, that's
awfully wise advice, Eric.
I took Slashdot seriously, I'd have gone insane 5 years ago.
That's true. I've seen some very cruel things said about you and myself as well. And but let's jump over to the real thesis of what I'm trying to get at here. I saw this phenomenon going on before myself, and looked at a lot of the history of what has been going on within the Linux community, and I've been sitting down and thinking seriously about the failure of attempts at producing a lot of commercially successful software. I'm not talking about the kernel development. I'm talking about commercial software. And a major percentage of, I don't really have a real valid number, it's got to be over 90% though, that of commercial software has utterly failed within the Linux community to reach commercial viability.
Mm-hmm.
Hasn't happened.
I think I know why.
Okay, why?
It's not because the Linux community doesn't work. It's because the traditional commercial model for producing software doesn't work anymore.
Bingo.
If that's true, if the commercial model
doesn't work,
how come Caldera/SCO just made $60 million off of a proprietary product?
From selling old product to old customers.
Okay.
What would be interesting, and what would refute the interpretation that I have, and maybe I'm wrong, I'm not magic, what would refute the interpretation that I have is if they had substantial uptake of SCO from new customers who had no history with the product.
Yep, that is going to be an interesting metric to watch.
Right.
And that's the key one. I mean, basically, you went into the Unix marketplace, and you found that they didn't like Linux. Or they didn't favor Linux. And I think that's going to be true because the Unix market and the Linux market have very little to do with each other.
That's true.
In fact, my history, too, is that where you find traditional Unixes, there's going to be resistance for Linux because Linux changes the rules.
Yeah.
And people don't like their markets screwed with. The problem is that the market, the traditional Unix market, is dying. It's been dying for some time. It's actually gotten a late life kicker off of Linux and open source, but only because it kept it from being stagnant. But the problem is that the marketplace is still dying, and so the entire way that
are you saying the Unix market is dying?
Yes.
Oh yes, that is definitely the case.
Yes, because the Unix market and the Linux market are not the same thing.
Yes. And furthermore, it's very clear how it's dying, and the reason that it's dying is the same reason why, fundamentally, I'm not worried about the transitory attitudes of a particular cohort of customers. Take Linux's market share, by any measure you like, and plot it against the fall in the price of the average PC. They are very nearly inverse curves. At at the basest economic level, the uptake of Linux is being driven by the commoditization of hardware, and that's a trend, that's a driver that is neither going to accelerate nor decelerate because of people's historical attitudes about a particular legacy product.
Okay, you're right. I will completely 100% agree with that statement, Eric.
Yeah.
And that is why I think my thesis about the GPL is valid. And that is because hardware has been, over the last 12 to 18 months, commoditized.
Yeah.
That's why you're seeing hardware show up at Walmart with Linux on it, because it makes it cheap.
Right.
Okay? So, once you've developed a product, you need software to sell on it.
Yeah.
Linux will grow to a certain point, or I should say those commodity PCs will sell to a certain point just because of the fact that people want to write letters and write email and surf the Internet.
Right.
Just that one small group of functions. But eventually, they're going to want software.
Mm-hmm.
The software doesn't exist. There has to be a motivation for commercial companies to write software for Linux.
Well, you know,
it's not going to happen with the GPL.
You've stuck a couple of premises in there. And here's where I say the most, I said before that I think the fundamental reason is that what you've been calling the commercial software model doesn't work anymore. Let me cite a couple of reasons why it doesn't work. One is technical. The technical reason that model is failing is because of Moore's Law. Moore's Law scales up machines by a factor of roughly 2 every 18 months in capability. And because marketeers seek features, they like to put things on their checklist, that means the average complexity of software has been rising on a similar exponential curve in lockstep with the capability of the machines. The problem with that is that the debugging problem gets worse as the square of the size of the software. A technical reason the traditional model doesn't work anymore is because all of the verification methods, all of the methods of holding bugs down to an acceptable level that were associated with closed source development have completely failed. That's the technical reason. Peer review is the only thing that works at current project scales.
Okay. Eric, you know, I would agree with you when you're talking about productivity software.
Yeah.
But
infrastructure also.
And infrastructure. Well, infrastructure.
Well, that's the kernel.
Infrastructure is a done deal. That's the kernel.
Yeah.
That's over. That world domination is done.
Yeah.
That is a won battle, and that's part of the problem.
So okay.
What's
so
the solution, Jeff?
What?
What's the solution?
No.
Stopping GPL?
I don't think so. You're missing something here, Arnie. What is the largest single entertainment industry on the planet?
Hollywood.
Nope.
No. It's video games.
So, Eric, although I agree with you about productivity software, you are dead wrong.
Well, excuse me. Video games take it to porn.
Video game development, you're absolutely wrong. The business model, the commercial development model, is alive and well at Activision, Sierra, you know, yada, yada, yada. The list is as long as your arm.
Okay, now we get to the economic reason the old model has failed to work, and this is one that hasn't quite bit the video game makers yet because they can operate on lower margins than most productivity software producers. The problem is that it's very hard. It used to be easy to hide a $1,000 software price in a $5,000 system cost.
That's right.
Now we're reaching the point where the typical price for a consumer PC is $400, and it's really hard to hide significant software costs in there. So the commoditization is exerting a squeeze on the margins that software producers can collect. And unless you're a monopoly, the margins that are available are no longer fat enough to support a traditional software development organization. The video game people haven't been bit by this because they can operate on lower margins than people who produce word processors and operating systems. But their time is probably coming.
Well, you know, also, it strikes me that the
louder
release cycle, the release cycle for video games is different from the traditional software. With if you release, say, a database system, you're going to need to be patching and upgrading and adding new features and so on and so forth, and you'll be up to version 9 within 5 years or something like this in the traditional cycle. Video games, they release, they issue bug fixes, and then they go on to the next entire product. Which
yeah, they hit big for $3 and they're gone. The whole business is different. You're absolutely right, Jeff, that video games have an economics that is much more like packaged goods than it is than like traditional software is, where there's a continuing service and upgrade requirement. For that reason, as I pointed out 3 years ago now in the Magic Cauldron, it's not real safe to try and extrapolate from the market dynamics of video games to the market dynamics of other software applications, because most of them are more complex. Most of them have a higher knowledge overhead, both for developers and for users, than is the case with video games. And that fundamentally changes whether it's possible to have things like a service contract model.
You're right on target, Eric.
Yeah, in that case, yeah. I would have a tendency of agreeing.
I mean, really, a video game is really, really an entirely different animal. Look at what Linux is doing at IBM, and you know, here I look at the latest eWeek, and I look at the back of the latest eWeek, and here's this absolutely huge ad with the largest letters in the ad, a gigantic Linux. It says unbreakable Linux, four computer cluster with Linux. Everybody knows Linux costs less. Now it's faster and more reliable too. And the company, Oracle.
Yep. And you know what? Who are going to be the biggest violators of the GPL?
Well, who knows?
IBM and Oracle.
Well, maybe so. But you know what?
Have you seen
gentlemen, I'm going to have to punch
Arnie,
out.
Have
so.
You seen one tool?
Been good talking to you.
Yeah.
I got a kid and I got a roll. So.
Okay, good night,
bye, Doc.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, Doc.
Have you seen one tool from IBM come out yet, open source? Nope.
Well, they contributed some code to the journaling file system.
Yeah, actually, they contributed a lot.
Early on. They did that early on.
Yeah, they did some minor things early on.
That was pretty major.
The journaling system was a big one. I will admit that. But there's an awful lot of what IBM is doing that they are not releasing the code GPL, and they are charging enormous amounts of money for a product that they're developing, especially when you're talking about
But they're using Linux, they're supporting Linux, and the way they're supporting Linux is part of their infrastructure.
Okay, yeah, okay.
I mean, when you buy a mainframe from IBM, you can say, I want Linux on it, and part of the deal is the support.
Okay, yeah. That's right, but you're willing to forgive the bending of the rules in the GPL for
IBM. How are they violating the GPL?
Yeah, what evidence do we have that that's happening?
I don't see any of that. And the guys at Slashdot will find it, but quick.
Yeah.
And even where it doesn't exist, it'll find it.
Yep.
And there's no evidence to this. If IBM's violating the GPL, no one said anything about it.
Well,
I haven't seen anything about it.
Okay,
as
about,
far as I'm concerned, IBM's been a good citizen.
The Linux toolkit for the Z-Series CPUs costs $5,000 per CPU. Okay? That is
okay.
Not GPL.
And there's also available a Debian version, which you can get for nothing.
Yeah, but that's not their code.
But there's a choice.
But
okay,
my point is, Arnie, is you're still turning your back on the GPL for IBM.
No,
I'm not.
No, what we need to know is whether the IBM's toolkit is actually a derivative under copyright law terms of GPL code. I'm not prepared
to... it's almost, according to Mad Dog, it's almost irrelevant if it's a derivative or not, if it hooks directly into the kernel.
That's a very controversial issue, actually.
Okay, but that's the interpretation of the executive director of Linux International.
Yeah.
And so I'm just going based upon what the executive director of Linux International says.
Yeah, there's a big gray area there near static and dynamic linking.
And so based upon that fundamental position that he has held since the first time I talked to him specifically about that issue was probably 97. And
yeah.
He has held that same exact line since 1997. And if the program hooks into the kernel while it's running, it must be GPL in his interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
So, based upon that statement, the IBM toolkit is a violation of the GPL.
Okay, fine. There is room for reasonable people to differ on this without a claim that one is turning one's back on the GPL. Because, quite frankly, the GPL is ambiguous about what is linkage.
And lots of code is still LGPL'd, and you can link to that fairly freely.
Yeah. There's a hardcore position, and I'm deliberately not stating my position on this, by the way. There's a hardcore position that any kind of dynamic linkage or calling linkage constitutes derivation for purposes of the GPL. And there's a less hardcore position that says, no, it's got to be static linking, or at most, dynamic linking in the way that Linux DLLs do it, or Linux SOs. Sometimes they're called DLLs for weird historical reasons.
Microsoft historical reasons.
Yeah. Although I have a position in that debate, I'm not prepared to say that I think other people who have different positions from me are turning their back or turning a blind eye or anything else. There are honest differences here.
And we'll keep the dialogue going. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, well, I've got to compliment you, Eric, and this is not a criticism, okay? This is a very complimentary comment. The political absolutist that you are, you're being very accommodating to other people's perspectives.
Well, you know, there are times when it's time to like bang the drum and blow the trumpet and stand up for the absolute position that you think is the most important one. And there are other times when you serve the cause of freedom best by just shutting up for a while.
Yeah, I'll agree with you there.
And if I have learned nothing else in the last 5 years, I think I've learned a lot about that kind of tactical choice.
Yes. Yep, I agree with you there. Because fundamentally, we're talking about a license. We're not talking about the Second Amendment, are we?
No.
And I have to say, you know, I've looked at the economics, I've looked at the politics, I've looked at our adoption rates. We're doing okay.
I think we've got several niches that we really have just really sewn up tighter than tight, and I see, you know, even the one I've railed against is all this desktop talk. I even see that giving way right now too.
Those walls are crumbling.
And I've always said that the desktop is irrelevant. You know, who cares about the desktop? You know, but you know now it seems we seem to be making some headway there. That's good. Everything's good. We're everywhere. We're throughout the industry. We're not going away, and the GPL is substantially part of the reason.
Well,
I mean, that's not all the reason, but it's part of the reason.
Here's where I start agreeing with Jeff.
And now I'm going to disagree with you, because my whole point in this is I think that the GPL is almost irrelevant and an argument of convenience by absolutists.
Well, I mean, that's fine, too. I'll accept that.
Here is where I agree with Jeff.
I accept that.
And I say that he contradicts his earlier position. I also happen to think that the GPL is pretty much irrelevant to our success. But if that's because all of the forces that I think are driving adoption are things for which the particular terms of the license are pretty much immaterial, the distinction between GPL and non-GPL.
I agree with that.
But I also want to point out that this contradicts Jeff's earlier gut-level conviction that the GPL is a problem. Now, it can be one of two things. It can either be irrelevant to our success or a roadblock in our path, but it's hard to see how it can be both.
Okay, I'll explain why. I think the GPL in the long term is irrelevant because, number one, I think it is legally indefensible, and number two, I think at times it's a bit of a farce the way some people will bend it depending upon the wind and the condition of the time. That's why I think it's irrelevant. I think this is an important issue legally, because the commercial software vendors that are out there, and in particular, Eric, the people who are making entertainment software, whether you're going to call it games,
right,
or travel programs or educational software,
mm-hmm,
encyclopedia programs, whatever you want to pick in that genre, okay, they are the ones that legally really do have a problem.
Well, they have a problem with all open licenses, not just the GPL.
No. Arnie, you're wrong.
I don't see them rushing to open or release their stuff under the BSD license or the Apache license or any of the other open licenses.
That's because
they're staying
no
proprietary.
Arnie, there's no critical mass there, and you know it.
Well, there's no critical mass because they're not least bit interested in making their systems open.
Yeah.
And nor should they be required to.
Okay. Well.
Not all software has to be GPL'd or Apache'd or BSD'd or anything else.
But there again, Arnie, your statement is correct that you just made. They should not be forced to make their stuff open.
That's right.
If they don't want to.
That's right. We don't live in a totalitarianistic society here.
However, the Linux community in large ways has beat the vendors over the head, twisting their arms to make everything open.
No. There's some markets for open, and I think there's some places, like, for instance, you mentioned education software. I think the schools would benefit dramatically. And that's where I am right now.
Speaking
by open software. I think that the schools could save fortunes. And furthermore, it's one of these custom vertical markets that's very narrowly focused and is government supported. And guess what? Open software makes sense here.
Speaking as the president of one of our two major advocacy organizations, I'll say that I haven't noticed the open source initiative twisting anybody's arm lately.
Nor anyone else, Eric, really.
The open source initiative doesn't.
Hey, Jeff?
And neither does Linux International.
Here comes Jeff.
Hey, Jeff.
I'm impressed with
it. The question I have is, if you're saying that the open source world is twisting everyone's arm, are you also prepared to say right now that your average /daughter will not buy and are not currently buying computer-based games?
Of course not.
Because this is the thing. The market is there in the open source world. Among they may prefer that it would be either free as in speech or free as in beer.
They're still buying their Activision game on their Win 98 box or their PS2.
Right.
They're still doing it. Of course they are.
Right.
But then they're beating up on the vendors that do come into the Linux industry because the beer ain't free.
Well, but somehow that isn't the issue here. The reason, as far as I'm concerned, that you're not seeing all these games and stuff is that there isn't enough presence on the desktop yet in the home market, which is where you're talking about video games, that these video game vendors are going to make buckets of money, which is their essential goal. And will that change? I think so, but it's not there now. So I mean, I think you're making a derivative here from a situation that doesn't quite follow. The reason why the video game vendors aren't doing this isn't because they're scared of criticism. I don't believe. I believe it is that they're not going to make buckets of money yet. And until they start making buckets of money, and that means having a large number of home users, they're not going to bother. I mean, it was the same sort of thing when I worked at Compaq. The argument I always got whenever I tried to talk to different groups about doing more Linux stuff is, how many truckloads of home PCs running Linux can we sell in a day? And until you can come up with a number that fits their marketing plan, they're not interested.
And it better be above the cost, the overhead to manufacture those and stuff like that.
But the thing is, it's got to be truckloads per day. If you're not talking truckloads per day, you're not talking about significant market as far as they're concerned.
Yeah, I understand the dynamics when you're talking about
And it's the same thing with the video game market. You know?
Yeah. Well, something else I'd like to point out is implicit in all of the discussion that we've been having is the assumption that there necessarily is a winning strategy in any of these markets. And I'm not clear that that's true.
That's a good point, too.
Some markets, either because of technological change or because of change in demand, after a while, don't become rich enough. They don't sustain sufficient margins to make running businesses in them profitable. One of the possibilities is that there are certain kinds of business which, due to the commoditization of hardware, just aren't profitable anymore. And I say that from painful experience as a former director of VA Linux Systems.
How much does a hard drive? I bought a hard drive this weekend, 80 gigabyte IBM, and I paid $80-some for it, $84.
And at that's a relatively high price.
That's a 7200 spin. That's not bad. I mean, it's for retail, it's not bad.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know where I could get them cheaper.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, price.com.
Not here in Ontario, California.
Yeah. There's my favorite computer shop is one of those hole in the wall outfits run by Taiwanese. I love those.
That's where I got
mine. That's the place to go for cheap hardware.
Yeah, that's where I got mine.
Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, this is an interesting debate, and I'm not sure we're done with it yet. but we are up to the clock. So what I'd like to do is chew this over for a couple more weeks. And Eric, can you come back in a couple weeks and we'll talk on it some more?
Just send me the notification, because I've been thinking about some of these issues for a long time, as you probably know.
Yeah, but unfortunately, Doc didn't have a chance to talk much. Doc and I have been talking about this a lot the last 2 weeks. That there are some things that if nothing else, we as a community need to be aware of so that we can learn from them in terms of the way that other parts of the IT industry are perceiving us, and that they're not going to play in our sphere unless we accommodate to them a little bit more. And so there's perhaps room for a little bit of wiggle to accommodate the rest of the consumer electronics industry in particular, if we really want dynamic growth within the next desktop, we need the consumer electronic industry to take us seriously. So, but we're out of time, so until next week, thank you everybody for coming by in the IRC chat room. We'll have more stuff posted for you come next week on the DSL wireless offering I was talking about, as well as the project for Radio Free Universe that we announced about a month ago. The guy we're working on the project with is working on the server that's going to be our platform to build on right now, so we're going to actually start assigning projects to people within the very near future on the Radio Free Universe project, and so we'll keep everybody apprised of that. So until next week, this has been the Linux Show for Tuesday, September 10th, 2002. We'll see everybody next week. We're out of here.
So you need an email server, huh? Well, check out one of our sponsors. What? The Linux Show has sponsors? Yeah, well, how the hell do you think we pay the bandwidth bill around here? No, it's really more the phone bill, not the bandwidth bill. Phone bill is killing us. But anyways, back to our sponsor. Check out the folks at www.littlebluebox.com and buy their stuff and sponsor.